KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Vladimir Putin says he will pause attacks on Ukraine's energy network, but did not sign on to a larger ceasefire proposal backed by the U.S. and Ukraine. So is a lasting peace possible? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. U.S.-backed broadcaster serving Europe, Asia, and the Middle East is fighting the Trump administration's efforts to pull funding. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We speak to its CEO, who says the cuts are a gift to America's enemies. Also, it's getting easier to get that induction stove without overhauling your wiring, and how a picture of a 19th century train crash inspired a new novel. It's Wednesday, March 19th. On this day in 1931, Nevada became the first state to legalize gambling. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is speaking now on the phone with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. They're likely discussing Trump's call yesterday with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This comes as Trump has canceled a U.S.-funded project to gather evidence of Russian war crimes in Ukraine. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The State Department confirms that it terminated a contract that supports the Ukraine Conflict Observatory. It did not explain why or respond to an allegation by a Democratic congressman who says he has reason to believe that some of the data from the program was permanently deleted. The Ohio Democrat, Greg Lantzman, is sending a letter to Secretary of State Marco Rubio warning, quote, this vital resource cannot be lost. As part of the contract, researchers at Yale University have been collecting evidence about tens of thousands of Ukrainian children abducted by Russia, evidence that's supposed to be used in war crimes trials. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Thousands of people in Israel have been protesting as the Israeli government restarted the war with Hamas in Gaza. Airstrikes have killed at least 400 Palestinians this week. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports many Israelis want negotiations to proceed.
In central Tel Aviv, protesters flooded the streets, carrying posters with the faces of Israeli hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza, and calling for a deal to have them all released immediately. If there's no deal, we will burn the country down, one group chanted, banging drums and marching. Polls show a majority of Israelis are against the end of the ceasefire and want talks to resume to get the remaining 59 hostages back. Many feel that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is forsaking the hostages in Gaza by returning to war and instead yielding to far-right members of his government who have been pushing to defeat Hamas. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump says his administration is appealing recent court decisions that have halted or reversed his executive actions. But as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the president says he will follow court orders.
President Trump has been highly critical of federal judges who he says are trying to usurp his presidential powers. He's even suggested impeachment, drawing a rebuke from Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. But when pressed by Laura Ingraham of Fox News, Trump said his administration would follow the orders.
I never did defy a court order.
And you wouldn't in the future?
No, you can't do that. However, we have bad judges. We have very bad judges. And these are judges that shouldn't be allowed. I think at a certain point, you have to start looking at what do you do when you have a rogue judge.
Trump said he is confident the Supreme Court will ultimately side with him. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 200 points. The Nasdaq is up more than 100. This is NPR. The Trump administration is threatening to pull federal funding from New York's Transit Authority. The government is demanding information about crime on the city's subways. At the same time, the Trump administration is trying to stop New York's new congestion fee on motorists who drive into the city. A recent memo by the Trump administration has told federal agencies that segregated facilities such as restaurants, waiting rooms, and drinking fountains are no longer explicitly banned in contracts. Businesses must still follow anti-discrimination laws. But NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports legal experts say this move is significant.
The change came in a public memo issued last month by the General Services Administration, which was prompted by President Trump's executive orders on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the one about gender identity. It includes a list of 9 clauses to exclude in future contracts. One of them explicitly prohibits contractors from having segregated facilities, like restaurants and housing and drinking fountains. Melissa Murray is a law professor at NYU. She says businesses still have to comply with laws that ban segregation and discrimination.
So it's symbolic, but it's incredibly meaningful in its symbolism.
She notes these civil rights protections from the federal government have been on the books since the 1960s. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
There are blizzard warnings up from eastern Colorado to eastern Minnesota this morning. Forecasters say heavy snow will spread over the central plains today, so will powerful winds. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faldel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we'll speak with the CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is suing after the Trump administration slashed its funding.
First, Russia and Ukraine launched strikes targeting each other's infrastructure last night.
This comes hours after President Trump and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, announced a limited ceasefire in Ukraine, where Putin agreed to stop targeting Ukraine's energy facilities for 30 days. That's far short of the end to fighting on land, air, and sea that the U.S. and Ukraine agreed to last week.
With us to explain where all of this stands is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, joins us from Kyiv. So, Eleanor, a deal between Presidents Trump and Putin, what does this mean for the war in Ukraine? Will that change anything?
Well, so far nothing has changed, because this is what the skies of Kyiv sounded like last night. I held my phone out our window. So you can hear the air defense shooting down drones. You know, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's been seeking a ceasefire to end attacks on people and civilian infrastructure, not just energy infrastructure. And he said on social media that these nighttime attacks by Russia are destroying the normal life of Ukrainians. He said the fact that these attacks continued right after Trump and Putin's call showed that maximum pressure must be put on Russia for the sake of peace.
What has Zelensky said about the possible ceasefire deal and Trump's conversation with Vladimir Putin?
Well, he does not trust Putin. And there seems to be a constant fear in Ukraine now of being thrown under the bus by the Trump administration, you know, being forced to make concessions, to capitulate. Zelensky had a long online press conference with journalists last night. And clearly the length of the 2.5-hour call between Presidents Trump and Putin was unnerving for him. And he was underwhelmed by the very limited agreement that came out of it, but he tried to show optimism because he has no choice, really. Let's listen.
Якщо такий перший крок, а поки що інших кроків немає,
You know, he's saying, if this is the first step and there are no other steps so far, then let's hear the details of how to proceed, and we will. And he just said he really hopes that President Trump will be able to put as much pressure on Putin as possible.
But how far apart you think Ukraine and Russia are, you know, on the terms of a possible deal?
Well, very far apart, actually. Analysts say there will have to be major concessions on both sides, and so far the Russian demands are maximalist. For example, Putin wants land that his army doesn't even fully control in provinces that he's already annexed and is calling Russian. That's a red line for Ukraine, and Putin has said he will only accept a deal if Ukraine stops getting military assistance from his allies. Ukraine and the EU have rejected that.
So you mentioned the EU. That's the other party in this whole thing. The rest of Europe, what are they saying?
Well, yesterday, French President Emmanuel Macron met with the Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz, and they said they will absolutely keep the military aid flowing to Ukraine. And Macron said any ceasefire must be verifiable and Ukrainians must be at the table. You know, Macron has said many times that Europe cannot let Russia win this war. Here he is speaking yesterday.
Nous continuerons de soutenir l'Ukraine face à la guerre d'agression.
He said, we will continue supporting Ukraine in this war of aggression because we know from our experience what it means to be occupied. And of course, he's talking about the Nazi occupation of France in World War II.
Yeah, you know, U.S. officials have been trying to reassure EU allies that they will be involved in any peace agreement. But the thing is, Eleanor, I mean, they haven't been. So, I mean, how do people feel about that?
Well, this is deeply shaking the continent. There's a view that Putin is stalling so he can continue the war and that he's playing with Trump, who Europeans believe is naive, has no experience with Putin, and wants a peace deal so badly he'll do anything. The former French ambassador to the U.S. went on French TV last night, Gérard Araud, and he sort of summed up the sentiment. He said Putin is just signing on to the peace deal not to annoy Trump, but he's testing the waters to see how far he can go. He says it's Putin's dream for Russia to be treated as a superpower dealing one-on-one with the American president over the heads of the Europeans.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is suing the United States Agency for Global Media after it pulled grants that fund the broadcaster. The Czech Republic-based news organization argues the Trump administration is not abiding by Congress's power of the purse, and it names officials, including Trump advisor Carrie Lake. She says this is about cost-cutting. To discuss the suit and what's at stake here, I'm joined in studio by Steve Kappas, the president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Layla.
So I want to, before we get to the lawsuit, I just want to give people a sense of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which has broadcast for 75 years. You share news in 27 languages to nearly two dozen autocratic countries with limited or no press freedoms like Russia. Now, Steve, when your funding was cut over the weekend, you called it a massive gift to America's enemies. Why a gift?
Because we're a lifeline to the people who live in those countries, and they have no access to information outside of largely government propaganda and other types of information like that. So we're leaving the information battlefield, if you will, to these countries like Iran, like China, all over our coverage area, by the way, Russia. And so at a time when there's so much happening in the world, think about what's the report we just listened to from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Think about what's going on in the Middle East. All of the U.S. international broadcasters, including Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, are threatened. VOA has gone silent.
Right. It's been replaced by music. What's the argument you're making in court?
Simply put, this was an unlawful act. USAGM does not have the ability to go around Congress. Congress has appropriated our funds. It's very clearly laid out in the budget, and we expect our funding. USAGM is simply in the position to administer a grant of congressionally appropriated funds.
Now, can you keep going without U.S. funding? As you pointed out, the Voice of America has been shuttered. There's been cuts to other private broadcasters like Radio Free Asia.
It's going to be tough. I mean, this is part of the reason why we went to court. We're living off of our savings right now, and we're in a position where we're going to have to take some pretty drastic actions in the not-too-distant future. Our audiences are already feeling the impact of the VOA shutdown, or even USAGM. They've turned off transmitters. So our audiences inside Iran, and we reach 10% of the Iranian audience on average every week, 6.5 million people. Those people have lost a significant part of their feeds, their radio feeds, because the USAGM transmitters have gone dark. That's what we're hearing from thousands of our normal audience members.
Now, you're based in Prague, and this week the Czech foreign minister asked the European Union to fill the gap in your funding. Can Europe fill the gap?
Well, we're immensely gratified that so many European nations have stepped up and said that they value this service. We've been around for 75 years. We've been in their neighborhoods, and they understand why it's necessary to stand up against Russia and China and Iran's growing malign influence all across the region, our investigative reports, things like that. They understand the value. Can they step up and fill the funding gap? We haven't gone forward to ask them that. We've been, for 75 years, we've looked to Congress to receive our funds, and we want to get this resolved. But if it comes to it, then we'll be looking at alternatives, and we have no choice. We can't let this vital institution go silent.
Well, let me ask about that. If you don't win in court, what happens to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and your journalists, including five journalists you have jailed in autocratic nations for their work?
I hate to think about it, because these people, think about it, they're being held in Russia, in Iran, in Crimea, Russian-controlled Crimea. They're being held in Azerbaijan and Belarus. Why do you think the leadership there is so threatened by our people? They're thrown into prison and because they want to silence us. This is the dedication of our people, and this is what's at risk. Those governments don't want us in there. I think whenever anybody wants to silence us, we should speak up.
Steve Kappas is the president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Two NASA astronauts are back on Earth after an extended stay on the International Space Station. Their mission was set to last only 8 days, but Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams ended up spending 9 months in orbit. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne has more on the astronauts' 286 days in space.
It was a picture-perfect return as the SpaceX Dragon capsule gently splashed down under a canopy of four parachutes just off the coast of Tallahassee, Florida.
And splashdown. Crew 9 back on Earth.
But their mission wasn't as smooth as their return. NASA astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams arrived at the station back in June in Boeing's Starliner spacecraft designed to take astronauts to and from the station. It was a test flight. But during their arrival, the crew encountered problems with the spacecraft's thrusters. Starliner docked successfully, but NASA decided it wasn't safe enough to take them home. Instead, they went with another company, Elon Musk's SpaceX, for the return journey. Starliner was sent back to Earth without a crew in August, and an already planned crew mission flew to the station in September with only two of its four seats taken by NASA's Nick Hague and Russia's Alexander Gorbunov. The empty seats were for Wilmore and Williams. The four returned home together.
Nick, Alex, Butch, Sonny, on behalf of SpaceX, welcome home.
During their extended stay, Wilmore and Williams became part of the station crew, conducting 150 unique science experiments and multiple spacewalks. NASA's Steve Stitch says despite the mission not going as originally planned,
Butch and Sonny's return on Dragon to me shows how important it is to have two different crew transportation systems.
NASA says Boeing is committed to flying Starliner again, although when that will happen and whether or not it will carry a crew is still unclear. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the promise and peril of artificial intelligence. Investigative reporter Gary Rivlin's new book tells the story of how AI was developed and how big tech firms are racing to build powerful systems with enormous potential for harm and profit. His book is AI Valley. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A famous photo from 1895 is the basis for many posters and the occasional social media meme. It shows an old-fashioned steam locomotive that couldn't stop, crashed all the way through a railroad terminal, and tumbled out onto the street on the far side. The novelist Emma Donoghue saw that photo. Her earlier novels include Room, which is the story of a mother and child trapped in a room, which became a film. Now Donoghue's novel, The Paris Express, tries to imagine what life was like for travelers on that train in 1895.
An express train set off from Granville on the Normandy coast and headed straight for Paris. It was only meant to stop four times along the route, and it was meant to get in by 4 o'clock. And it all went horribly wrong, Steve.
Hmm.
There were some important guests on the train, you know, VIPs. There were three members of parliament. And one of them asked, could the train possibly stop near his country house for his carriage to be put on? And that delayed the train by 10 minutes, which was enough to bring on disaster because the driver and stoker, the entire crew, would have felt under massive pressure to get to Paris on time despite this delay.
This would have counted, I think, as a minor train accident and not remembered to history at all, except for a particular photograph.
You're so right. In fact, it's a cluster of photographs. Lots of people rushed to the scene of the disaster and took pictures, amateurs as well as professionals. But all of them show an incongruous image of a train plunging out a window almost vertically. I don't know how I hadn't come across it in half a century, maybe because I never was in residence at a university and it's a very popular dorm room image. But basically, it's that combination of modernity and high tech and really impressive signs of industry and speed, and then complete disasters.
You said that you, until recently, were not familiar with this image as a poster and a bit of pop culture. So what got you interested in the story?
I happened to be going to live in the area of Montparnasse in Paris for a year because my partner is a French professor. That was the only place we could find a three-bedroom flat for us and our large children. Mm. So I Googled it, and the first thing I saw was multiple copies of this photograph from 1895. And I just thought, that's the most arresting image I've ever seen. And I looked it up and thought, why has nobody written a novel about this?
Now, you could have made up everything except the final image, but you seem instead to have done a bunch of research. How did you go about learning about this?
You know, I find the facts are often more amazingly strange than anything I could make up. I research things really very much as if I'm doing solid history. You know, I use databases, I use newspapers. I was able to look up a wonderful hoard of bureaucracy. But then there always comes a moment when the facts run out. So I enjoy making stuff up just as much.
When you're making stuff up, I'm interested in this detail. Sometimes writers of historical fiction will say, I make stuff up that is consistent with the historical record, that could have happened even if nobody knows that it did. Do you try that?
Yes. For instance, I didn't have an individual coffee seller person to use on my train, but I spotted in a photograph in the Paris Historical Museum, I spotted an amazing image of somebody wearing a gigantic tank on their back, full of hot coffee,
huh,
which he served out of little taps on his chest. And I thought, okay, that is clearly credible for the time to have a human coffee pot serving the busy commuters. And what a modern image.
When you began learning about some of the passengers on the train, what are some of the kinds of people you found?
We all know that on a train, there's going to be a vivid example of the class system because people are literally segregated into nice red velvet covered carriages in first class and then horrible cramped carriages in third class. But I also found diversity in other ways because France was the center of its own empire, right? So you've got Cambodian students, you've North African coffee sellers, you've expats, American painters visiting like Henry Ossawa Tanner. You have troublemakers and anarchists and lowlifes visiting Paris. You have inventors, you have writers, you have queers, you have feminists.
Well, let's remember what railroads were doing in the 1800s when they were the hot new technology. How were they changing society?
Well, for instance, on my train, the local makers of Camembert, they were able to ship their cheeses across the world before the cheeses got too stinky. So suddenly, your man and woman in a village in Normandy could ship their cheeses to New York, and that meant they could actually stay in their village and they could make money there. So it had a huge influence on the settlement patterns, emigration patterns. Trains were astonishingly central to the shaping of Europe. It was the perfect vehicle for a novel because a train moves from beginning to end with unexpected events along the way, just like a novel.
And I think you're right that it's transforming commerce, but also communication, but also society and where people live and how people work and essentially everything.
Oh, and time, for instance. Suddenly you have to have standardized time zones because the trains were the first things that could, you know, whiz from one state in America to another fast enough that they might actually collide with each other if they weren't working on the same time. So suddenly people had to start standardizing their watches.
Did the experience of writing this book change the way that you thought about the next time you were checking email or doing something online or whatever you were doing in modern times?
You know, writing this book didn't turn me into a Luddite, but it certainly helped me think in a very practical way about the costs of our technology and our longing to get there faster and easier and smoother. The ideal of the frictionless life, it's always based on somebody else's hard labor.
If it didn't turn you into a Luddite, what did it do? Just make you try to appreciate all the unseen parts of our lives?
Yes, and be aware that you can make decisions. I mean, you know, one of the reasons the train crashed is, I would say, the big railway companies, they had an implicit policy of, yeah, go ahead and speed. You know, in theory, the drivers weren't meant to speed, but the company was like, we'll give you all a good big bonus if you get to Paris on time, despite delays, you know, and any delays caused by the passengers. Can you make up that time, please? It also made me think a lot about my own mortality, actually, because the train, again, starts to seem like an image of a human life. You know, you think you have all the way till Paris, but there can be an interruption and a derailment at any moment.
I am thinking of the popular internet phrase, move fast and break things, which has been repeated a lot recently because of Elon Musk's actions in Washington. This train was moving fast and breaking things. And you note the historical fact that the crew was in no way particularly punished for the crash.
No. These were just seen as the costs of doing business, to use another cliche.
Emma Donoghue is the author of The Paris Express, her latest novel. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. It's been all mine, Steve. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
In 2022, the Chinese government told NPR's Emily Fang she was no longer welcome in China, where she had lived and reported for 7 years. Even so, she says she hasn't lost claim to her Chinese identity.
Being Chinese is not confined to the boundaries of the People's Republic of China.
I'm Elsa Chang. My conversation with NPR's Emily Fang on her new book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More Israeli airstrikes today in Gaza. These strikes more than 24 hours after Israel broke its ceasefire with Hamas with surprise overnight attacks at Gaza health officials say killed more than 400 people and wounded hundreds more. Israel is attempting to extract new ceasefire terms for the release of more hostages before end-of-war talks. NPR's Daniel Estrin has public reaction to the sudden airstrikes.
It came as a surprise to many Israelis and the public, too. Many recently freed hostages spoke out yesterday about this return to war. We counted more than half of the living Israeli hostages recently freed by Hamas said the move endangered the lives of other hostages still in Gaza.
A federal judge is blocking President Trump's effort to ban transgender troops from military service. She says the order violates a service member's constitutional rights. The administration has until Friday to appeal. Ruling was a second against the administration yesterday, issued within hours of Trump's call for the impeachment of another judge who blocked migrant deportation flights. Trump repeated that point last night to Fox News' Laura Ingraham.
Many people have called for his impeachment, the impeachment of this judge. I don't know who the judge is, but he's radical left. He was Obama appointed.
Yesterday, U.S. Chief Justice John Roberts issued a rare public rebuke saying legal disagreements should be addressed through the appeals process, not through impeachment. From Washington, this is NPR News. About 40 people are missing. Six bodies have been recovered after a rubber dinghy carrying migrants toward Italy sank in the central Mediterranean Sea. We have more from NPR's Ruth Sherlock.
Survivors say the dinghy started to deflate just a few hours after they set off from Tunisia. They told the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, there had been some 56 people on board at the outset. Many were from Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Guinea and Mali, risking everything for hope of a better life in Europe. The seas were rough and survivors say many fell overboard during the crossing and disappeared under the waves. The UN Missing Migrant Project says more than 24,500 people have died trying to make this journey since 2014. It says the true number could be higher because some boats sink, leaving no survivors to account for the tragedy. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
In the U.S., the Federal Reserve's policymakers conclude their two-day meeting today. Investors are watching to see where the central bankers come down on interest rates and overall concerns about an economic slowdown from President Trump's tariffs and federal government-wide cuts. Many economists are projecting the Fed will keep its key interest rate unchanged. Inflation's been cooling, but still remains above the central bank's 2% target. The Dow is up 241 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Some U.S. doctors say they are increasingly afraid after a doctor in New York was indicted for mailing abortion pills to a woman in Louisiana. Louisiana officials have demanded the doctor's extradition to face charges. New York has refused. As Rosemary Westwood from member station WWNO in New Orleans reports, the case has raised the stakes for providing abortion care across state lines.
This is the first time criminal charges have been brought against a doctor for mailing abortion medications. After the news broke, staff at a reproductive health clinic in Maine became anxious. They also ship pills to patients in other states.
It just hit home that this is real. Like this could happen to anybody at any time now, which is scary.
Dr. Kohar Dersermonian is the clinic's medical director, but she reminded her staff that they knew a case like this was coming.
We didn't know how or to who or what charges, right? But we knew that this was going to happen.
To protect their doctors, New York, Maine, and six other states have passed laws that block extradition in such cases. But this will be the first test of these shield laws. Dersermonian says the indictment reminded her of the risks to her clinic and herself.
But still something I'm willing to continue to do because it's what's right.
Telemedicine is now playing a critical role in abortion access. In states with bans on abortion, more than 7,000 people a month are ordering pills to end their pregnancies, and demand is growing. Take the Massachusetts Medication Abortion Access Project. Last year, the clinic mailed pills to nearly 500 patients a month. Now, they're shipping to 3,000 a month. Angel Foster directs the clinic and says the indictment will not stop them.
It has not changed our practice. It has not changed our intention to continue to practice.
Foster has four doctors on staff and is hiring a fifth. She says they've created an organizational structure to spread out the liability.
The person who orders the pills is different than the person who prescribes the pills, is different from the person who ships the pills.
Doctors who prescribe under shield laws may be protected from prosecution in their home states. But if they travel to other states, they lose that protection. Julie F.K. is a human rights lawyer who helps doctors open telemedicine abortion practices. She says they know if they do this work, there are some parts of the country they shouldn't go.
There's really a commitment not to visit those banned and restricted states. We didn't have anybody going to the Super Bowl or Mardi Gras or anything like that. And I've talked to doctors where it's not a good fit because they have an elderly parent in Florida or a college student somewhere or family in the South.
If the New York doctor is convicted, she could face up to 5 years in prison. Liz Merle is Louisiana's attorney general. Speaking to Fox 8 News in New Orleans, she criticized New York for refusing to extradite the doctor. Dr. Samantha Glass works in New York. She thinks some doctors will stop mailing pills because of the increased scrutiny and fear. But Glass believes abortion should be as accessible as any other health care, and she's planning on joining a New York practice that sends pills across state lines.
Someone has to do it, so why wouldn't it be me? I just think, you know, access to this care is such a life-saving thing for so many people that I just couldn't turn my back on it.
New York shield law has protected the doctor so far. But legal experts say if Louisiana is determined, they could take their fight to federal court. For NPR News, I'm Rosemary Westwood in New Orleans.
About a third of the country's climate pollution comes from buildings. Now, one way to reduce that is to switch from fossil fuel burning appliances to electric ones. Thing is, that can require expensive electrical upgrades, but manufacturers are working to make it easier. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
In a Manhattan apartment, Max Van Gilder is making spaghetti carbonara.
Mix the eggs and garlic together.
On his new stove, there's pork sizzling in a frying pan. Van Gilder is a retired pediatrician and wanted to replace his old gas stove with a new electric one.
As I'm getting older, I was afraid that I would leave the gas on.
And to save energy, he wanted an induction stove that heats pans with magnetism rather than flames. But switching required expensive electrical work. Then he found a company called Copper. It makes induction stoves that plug into a regular outlet. A battery under the oven charges through the night and powers the stove, eliminating the big plug most electric ranges have. Van Gilder likes his new stove, but it came with a hefty price.
The base price is $6,000. There's a tax credit that brings it down to about $4,000.
Copper CEO Sam Kalish says that's still a bargain for older multifamily buildings with gas pipes that sometimes leak climate-warming methane.
In these cases, we install for less than half of what it costs just to fix the gas system. And then we allow that building to retire that old aging infrastructure and decarbonize it.
Beyond stoves, companies are making heaters and air conditioners that plug into a standard outlet. Joe Soto is testing one in his Woodside, New York apartment.
I call ourselves the guinea pigs.
The New York City Housing Authority used to heat Soto's home with steam radiators.
No, it wasn't very reliable. There are times that we spent many winters freezing in the cold.
Now his two-bedroom apartment has three window heat pumps that save energy by extracting heat in one place and moving it to where it's wanted, similar to how a refrigerator works. These heat pumps are mounted like a window air conditioner, and Soto says they also cool his apartment in the summer.
The temperature's been constant. The winter and the summer, you don't feel the difference.
One company making these window heat pumps is Gradient, where Vince Romanin is the founder and chief technology officer.
We can install our system without any building modification, without any electricians, without holes in the wall, without asbestos mitigation, without scaffolding. All of these things. It is 30-minute install, so we're in and out of the resident's home.
Heat pump technology is used in water heaters, too, and there's a plug-in version designed to replace a gas water heater.
It was all done in one day. It wasn't a major overhaul.
Laura Nakamura in Concord, California, got one last year and says it's louder than her old gas one because there's a fan, but it also blows cold air, which should cool down her garage in the summer. And it works as well as her gas water heater did.
It's just as hot, and the water is still just as wet.
She jokes, but plug-in heat pump water heaters do take longer to warm up. James Courtney is with the water heater manufacturer Rheem.
Because of the slower recovery, we do often recommend that those are installed in warmer states. Really, the main thing is the incoming groundwater temperature.
Warmer water requires less energy to make it hot. Rheem says water heaters like this are still a small portion of the overall market, but the fastest growing. And Panama Bartholomew with the Building Decarbonization Coalition says more products like this are coming.
I know there are manufacturers that are looking about putting batteries inside heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems.
He says those will plug into a regular outlet too, and with a battery, they'll continue working when the power goes out. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
New podcast by the Boston Globe's investigative team Spotlight examines the role confidential informants play in police work and the misconduct in that system. Next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. It's an aquatic glow-up, the blobfish. Well, looks like it sounds. It's sort of a blobby tadpole. Government scientists call it a mass of pale, jelly-like flesh with puffy, loose skin. It was called the world's ugliest animal back in 2013. Rough! But now the blobfish is getting its due. It's been voted New Zealand's Fish of the Year. Conservationists behind the vote say it has an unconventional beauty. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. With the Trump administration trying to lay off tens of thousands of federal workers, some Democratic governors are sensing an opportunity. WESA's Tom Reese reports they want fired federal workers to apply for state positions.
At a recent job fair in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro signed an executive order directing state agencies to consider federal experience on par with state experience. It's a move that he hopes will fill nearly 6,000 open positions with the state for registered nurses, civil engineers, and accountants.
If they're qualified and they want to serve Pennsylvanians, well, hear me on this. We want you on our team.
Like Shapiro, Hawaii Governor Josh Green.
I'm fighting to make sure people who lose their jobs can get a job through Operation Hire Hawaii.
And New York Governor Kathy Hochul.
Come join our New York State family.
Have announced campaigns to appeal to federal workers who are new to the job hunt after sweeping government layoffs. Pennsylvania is home to more than 100,000 federal employees, and it's unclear exactly how many lost their jobs since Donald Trump took office. But in its first week tracking former federal applicants, the Pennsylvania office in charge of hiring says at least 700 people disclosed they used to work for a federal agency, and they've applied to over 1,000 positions. But not all federal employees say they're ready or even willing to go back to government agencies.
Oh, geez, I have to figure out what to do next.
Megan Schwob, a former U.S. Forest Service worker, was laid off in February in Oregon. After what she says has been nearly a month of uncertainty, she moved back across the country and home to Minnesota. She'll soon start a job in the private sector, despite calling the Forest Service her dream job.
I think damage has kind of been done for a lot of people who, it's been a couple weeks now, where people have really had to find new jobs and start new lives.
She says in her case, there might not be a job at the state level that matches what she did to maintain national forests.
There's just not as much correlation from the couple million acre public land to a smaller state-run park or facility.
Salaries likely differ too, says Philip Glover, who heads the union, the American Federation of Government Employees, in Pennsylvania and Delaware.
Usually the state is a little lower starting salary. It depends on the job, obviously.
But Republicans in Pennsylvania have expressed concern about hiring federal workers fired for poor performance. That's what many of their termination letters say. Republican State House Leader Jesse Topper says it comes down to efficiency.
Sometimes that doesn't take more people. Sometimes that takes less. But whoever we have in those jobs certainly need to be competent and doing their jobs efficiently.
Glover, with the union, says actually working for the federal government is a pre-qualification for working for the state.
Clearly, these were political terminations. These weren't for cause.
More than 500 employees in his local union have filed for unemployment. And he says many are waiting to see what effect judges' rulings have on reinstating some agency workers. As far as Pennsylvania, Glover says,
I think the governor stepped out there and did some things that some of the other states aren't doing, and we appreciate his willingness to do that.
The AFGE and other federal unions will monitor judges' rulings on whether workers can have their jobs back, and states will keep trying to entice feds to work for them instead. For NPR News, I'm Tom Reese in Harrisburg.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal jury in San Antonio says two men are guilty for the roles in the deaths of 53 migrants, including six children. It was the deadliest human smuggling incident in modern U.S. history. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flab reports on Tuesday's verdict.
Felipe Orduña Torres and Armando Gonzalez Ortega faced the rest of their life in prison for the deaths that took place in the back of a tractor trailer without air conditioning in the South Texas sun. The men were both found guilty of all charges ranging from smuggling the people into the country to the overarching conspiracy that resulted in the migrants' injuries or deaths. Migrants dying while being smuggled into the country have been found many times throughout the past decade, but this was especially egregious, says San Antonio immigration attorney Jonathan Ryan.
It remains the largest single casualty event of its type in Texas and potentially in the United States. That is in terms of those who have been discovered.
The men are part of an international smuggling operation, federal prosecutors say. Five others have already been convicted or pleaded guilty, also facing potential life sentences. The case showed a vast network of human smuggling crossing multiple countries that have spurred other investigations and international indictments. After the verdict, federal prosecutor Eric Fuchs showed images from inside the sealed tractor trailer to reporters showing claw marks.
Claw marks from when they were desperately clawing at the sides, trying to get out. You could see that insulation, the scraps of it, and how it's fresh right below the claw marks.
The people who died came from Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. The tractor trailer in which they were found came from Laredo, Texas. 11 people survived the devastating trip and are still in the United States with the opportunity to apply for U visas, which are given to non-citizens who are victims of some crimes. Orduña Torres and Gonzalez Ortega will be sentenced June 27th. I'm Paul Flab in San Antonio.
The 65,000 delivery workers in New York City, deliveristas, became essential workers in the early days of the pandemic. WNYC's Arun Venugopal looks back 5 years later.
The other day, Gustavo Akje sat outside the New York Stock Exchange. Tourists from around the world were milling about, taking pictures in front of the statue known as Fearless Girl.
This is my area.
Akje is the founder of Los Deliveristas Unidos. The group represents workers who deliver the meals that New Yorkers order via DoorDash and other apps. He says just thinking about Manhattan 5 years ago when the city streets were desolate makes him sad.
Because most of the time during the pandemic, like at 3 or 4 p.m., this street was so quiet, you're not seeing nobody.
No one except for delivery workers. The vast majority are immigrants, and they kept bringing New Yorkers their meals and medications on e-bikes and mopeds. It wasn't easy. The streets were eerily quiet, and delivery workers were vulnerable to assault and robbery. So they formed WhatsApp groups to stay in touch with each other.
They say, hey, you okay? Yes, I just dropped the food on my way back. Okay, you're safe.
But Akje felt the rest of the city was hardly giving the workers much thought. If you lived through the pandemic in New York, you might have leaned out your window every evening and banged a pan for essential workers. This was Harlem in April of 2020.
Every time New Yorkers will come out of the doors to clap, they will mention every worker who was in the front line except deliveristas.
Ligia Hualpa runs the Workers' Justice Project and joined forces with Akje early in the pandemic. They fought to improve pay and safety for delivery workers and help New Yorkers understand this is essential work. Hualpa's voice cracked as she told the story of one worker who delivered a case of water through heavy rain. The ride took 30 minutes and paid $4. No tip. By the time he arrived, Hualpa says he was exhausted and furious.
And when somebody opened the door, it was an old lady on a wheelchair. And he said, at that moment, I cried because I was like, I'm helping somebody that cannot get access to basic services. And he said, at that moment, I understood what my role was.
The efforts to initiate change began to pay off. In 2021, the workers secured a raft of city laws improving their pay and working conditions. And last month, DoorDash agreed to pay nearly $17 million to settle claims that it withheld tips meant for thousands of delivery workers. A DoorDash spokesperson said the settlement was related to an old pay model that's since been retired. But Hualpa says the results have been validating.
It's a beautiful story that explains the power that a small grassroots organizing group has built in the city of New York.
Gustavo Akje says he's proud of what's been achieved since the pandemic and that delivery workers are not done fighting. For NPR News, I'm Arun Venugopal in New York.
Music fans from around the world are remembering Honduran folk musician Aurelio Martinez. He died this week in a plane crash near the Honduran island of Roatan. 11 others also died.
That's so beautiful. Martinez grew up in a remote area of northern Honduras. He moved to the port city of La Ceiba at the age of 14 to study music and eventually launched his performing career alongside Belizean musician Andy Palacio.
Martinez was called an ambassador of Garifuna music. It's a blend of reggae, Latin, and calypso. Here he is at his NPR Tiny Desk concert in 2015 explaining the cultures and influences that make up Garifuna music.
Garifuna music is a special music. This culture comes from a special mix with African people and Arawak Indian in the Caribbean island in St. Vincent. From this mix come from a new culture, Garifuna culture, Garifuna community. Welcome to Garifuna Nation.
In 2005, Martinez took a break from performing to become the first Afro-Honduran elected to the country's National Congress. But he left politics after a few short years to return to his true love, making music. That included international tours, Garifuna songwriting workshops for kids, and three more studio albums.
Last year, one of those releases, Landini, was named one of the best Latin American albums of all time by music journalists from the region. Aurelio Martinez was 55 years old. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faudig.